This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of all the important news. I'm Joel Hilliker, and with me is our panel. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello there.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
Hi.
The Senate impeachment trial in the United States of America concludes soon, possibly today. Democrats are doing their level best to ensure that Donald Trump is never able to hold public office again. And if he isn't convicted, they are ready to pursue other strategies for accomplishing this goal. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, this thing's been going on all week. Started Monday, could wrap up today. We'll see. It's today's when Trump's team's finally kind of like mount his defense. Monday through Thursday was all accusations. It's really the whole thing's it's like the Ringling Brothers Circus, because it's you're watching these, and I actually haven't even watched much of the live footage, but there's like, this is an impeachment trial against a man who's not even in office right now, which is weird to try to hold a trial to remove someone from office who's not in office. There's no Supreme Court justices involved in this at all. Normally the Chief Justice is supposed to preside. But they haven't been able to get anyone at the Supreme Court who wants anything to do with this sham. And so you look at these hearings, and it's just video after video after video of the protest at the Capitol. I mean, because that's the case they're trying to make, is that Trump incited this insurrection. And so you're having to focus in on just these few people who are protesting. But it's the Federalist had a good piece on it called like Trial by Feelings, because I mean, to make a case that the point of the case is not even prove whether there was an insurrection or not. The point of the case is you have to prove that Donald Trump incited it.
Yeah.
And so no amount of videos of violence, and as our executive editor, Mr. Stephen Flaherty, has pointed out on his program, it's like five people died and four of them were of either heart attack or some other natural cause from just the stress of the day. So it's like there was one person killed in this insurrection, and was killed by the police officers.
A Trump supporter killed by a police officer.
And so there's, as far as a violence insurrection, it's like there was no deaths at the hands of Trump supporters. I mean, yeah, they did break the law by breaching the Capitol, but the vandalism was small. You're looking and you're trying to pin this on the president when he gave a speech during the rally saying calling for peace and calm.
Yeah.
So it does. I think we're probably one of the notes one of the articles we can put in the show notes is from our editor in chief, Gerald Flory, from last year's impeachment trial. This is just shaping up to be an annual event in America. But we can put in our notes an article from our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Flory, from last year's impeachment trial entitled A Dangerous New Age of Worshipping the Will Is Here, because you definitely see the same thing on an even greater scale in some ways this year, where there's no facts, no evidence, no smoking gun that President Trump did anything wrong. The only thing they have on him is that he gave a speech during this rally calling for people to peacefully protest election theft.
Now, if I understand, the this is totally different from a criminal trial in the sense that the burden of proof on the prosecution, they have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that there was specific intent to incite. And in this case, it's just whatever the senators feel like. There, it's not like a criminal vote or a criminal prosecution. It's just, what do you think?
Right, because like I mentioned earlier, there's not even a judge in the room.
Yeah.
And like I said, and the people doing the prosecuting, you said, yeah, they're not bringing forth evidence. It's all just, try to find a clip of something bad that happened at this protest, play it for people over and over and over and over and over again.
Yeah.
In enough to like get them upset, and then they'll claim, well, that's his fault. No proof that it's his fault. It's just that's what that will worship article is about. That like if you just keep saying this over and over and over again, they're just hoping to finally get just bend enough people to their will.
Yeah. So they need 67 senators to decide to impeach for this to actually go through to convict. By all indications, they're nowhere near that. So this is really a lot of theater that is aimed at trying to smear Donald Trump as much as they possibly can. And Democrats, if they can't get what they want, if they don't actually convict him here, they've got other plans in the works as well.
Yeah, they've got the other plan. Because, I mean, the point with this, and I think that is the reason they went for an incitement to insurrection charge here, is that there is a Section 3 of the 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution bars anyone who's taken an oath to the Constitution and then been involved in insurrection against it from ever holding public office. And so their hope was that if they could get the 67 senators to convict him, even if they weren't in office, that they could bar him from office permanently. Now, I think no one believes that's gonna happen. The senators won't, but they do have plans that they're like, well, we could pass a Senate resolution that's not an impeachment after the fact, after he's not impeached, accusing him of insurrection. And then at least you have that Senate resolution as an asterisk by his name and try to use that legally to bar him from office. Now, legally, that doesn't hold water, but we've already established that this isn't really about law. This is about will worship, just trying to make him guilty in the eyes of enough people to bar him from holding office. And so if you can't do that through a legal impeachment trial, you do it through a sham impeachment trial. And if you can't do it through a sham impeachment trial, then maybe do it through a sham Senate resolution, but they'll keep trying till they get something.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting to see all of this going on. It definitely exposes their absolute determination to do everything they can to stop this man, which seems to suggest that they are pretty fearful that he could actually make a political comeback. And that in itself is interesting, given the fact that our editor-in-chief, Gerald Flurry, has talked about the prophecies that give the strong indication that he is going to make a political comeback, and it could be sooner than later. And even that, it shows you the outcome of all of these efforts.
Right, yeah, that is ironic in that way, in that these radical Democrats, it seems like, in just judging by their behavior, it seems like they're more afraid that the article from Mr. Flurry on why I still think Donald Trump's coming back could be correct,
right?
Because if they were fully convinced that that was wrong, I mean, just let it go. But yet the fact that just over and over and over and over again, they're trying to do anything to stop him from coming back to office does kind of give way that they're really concerned that he's coming back to office.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, why I still believe Donald Trump is coming back is the article from our editor in chief. We'll link to that, as well as that Will Worship article that he wrote a couple years back. Pretty remarkable times that we're living through in the United States of America. We appreciate you bringing that to us, Andrew. Now, before we leave American politics, we're going to look at what some are calling a deafening silence from the Biden administration after more than 3 weeks in office. To learn about this, we'll turn to Brent Noctegal.
Yes, the greatest ally of the United States in the Middle East is yet to receive a phone call from the Biden administration. This comes after weeks of being in office and calling over 10 world leaders, including having a two-hour phone call with Xi Jinping, the leader of China. And yet, Benjamin Netanyahu has not yet got a call. And this is something that's very different from, obviously, what President Trump, his foreign policy, looked to strengthen the ties between Israel and the United States, and also a familial bond as well, indicating that his presidency was going to favor Israel, was going to help solidify America's relationship with Israel by a series of pro-Israeli moves, and also recognize that in the region, Israel acts in the United States. It's in the United States' best interest to have a close friend of Israel. But even President Obama before, we've often spoken about how fraught that relationship was between Netanyahu and Obama, and there's famous pictures of them sitting there gritting through interviews in the Oval Office with the media there, and just the animus, but in the eyes of one another as they look at each other. Even he, Mr. Obama, called Prime Minister Netanyahu within the first couple of days of coming into office. Now it's been quite some time, over 3 weeks, and yet Mr. Netanyahu hasn't received a call. And there was an uproar on social media this week because Danny Dannon, the former UN ambassador for Israel, he called out Biden on this and said, "Hey, what gives? Why not a phone call to your greatest ally in the Middle East?" Obviously, there's plenty of Republican politicians that are calling on Biden to strengthen the relationship with the greatest ally in the Middle East. Jen Psaki, the White House press secretary, she said this on Thursday. She said that Biden looks forward to speaking with Netanyahu. And then she said, and obviously there's an important relationship that the United States has with Israel on the security front and as a key partner in the region. He'll be talking with him soon. And so it's just interesting, just that terminology. We have a relationship with them on the security front, and they're a key partner in the region. Nothing about how this is the greatest ally that the United States has in the region, that we share intelligence with each other on the security front, but also that we are standing by Israel 100%. And so this is a big sign to everyone out there where the United States is going to have its priority underneath President Biden.
It seems like something like the order of phone calls that the president makes might be kind of an unimportant detail, but these really are the ways that governments send diplomatic signals. And this is no surprise, given, as you said, the history that Joe Biden has with the Obama administration and statements that he's made about Israel relative to other nations in the region. Looking at this prophetically, the relationship between the United States and Israel is discussed in a sense in Bible prophecy, and we have been talking about what we expect in this relationship for a while. We kind of put this on hold a little bit during the Trump years because there was this an extraordinary strengthening of this relationship. But what we're seeing here is more of what we are expecting to see between these two nations.
Yes, and I think the fact that President Trump was so strong as a supporter of Israel, that it's even going to make any support for the Israelis-United States relationship a very polarizing issue now. And now it's like, if you're pro-Israel, you're also pro-Trump. It's seen in that light, which is going to really affect the relationship between Israel and the United States going forward. Now, this prophecy you're referring to is found over in the book of Zechariah chapter 11 and verse 14. It says this: "Then I cut asunder my other staff, even bands, that I may break the brotherhood between Judah and Israel." So this is a prophecy, book of Zechariah. This part of it's written around 500 BC, long after Israel and the southern kingdom of Judah went into captivity. And yet it's talking about a future breaking of this relationship. And so you know that this is referring to end time nations. Judah obviously is the nation of Israel today, made up of Jews. And then the main leading nation of Israel is the United States of America. And people can prove that reading Herbert W. Armstrong's book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. And so here we have a prophecy that in the latter days, you are going to have a breaking of this relationship, the brotherhood And President Obama has been very committed to breaking that relationship. And now Joe Biden seems to be, or not seems to be, is on course to break it even further, perhaps to a point that it's even irrevocable, at least in the minds of the media in America and in the minds of many anti-Trump voters. It used to be that Israel support was something that happened across the board, bipartisan support. Now it is, if you support Israel, well, that was what Trump supported. It's going to become harder for the for Democrats to become pro-Israel. Going forward, just because it's become toxic, as many people would see. So this is something that we expect, well, we know is going to take place, and this further hardening of positions inside America, making Israel a partisan topic, is going to lead to the breaking of this brotherhood in the long run. If people want to read more about this prophecy, they can read an article from a few years ago by Mr. Stephen Flurry entitled Band of Brothers.
Well, thank you very much for that, Brent. Over now to China and a very interesting story that emerged from this past January 16th, something one analyst said could mark the fatal moment for the American empire. For this, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, this news actually happened a few weeks back, as you said, but it has only just started to make its way into the Western press. But what happened is the People's Bank of China established a joint venture on January 16th with SWIFT. SWIFT is the global system for international monetary transfers, and this this joint venture that they set up, the purpose of it is to promote the use of China's new digital yuan for payments in cross-border trade around the world. So for many years, the U.S. dollar has been the main currency for international exchanges. You know, if Australia wants to buy computers from Japan, or if Denmark wants to buy cocoa beans from Nigeria, that happens mainly in dollars. Almost 90% of international transactions are in dollars. And this is, it's actually a big part of what makes America such a powerful economic superpower. It gives the U.S. major leverage over almost anyone that imports or exports anything. So some nations that don't like America have been working to chip away at America's dominance in the SWIFT system and just in the global reserve currency situation in general. And now this new Chinese digital currency partnered with SWIFT could really be a game changer. The Frontier Post published a powerful report about this a few days ago, and they wrote, "It's early days, but the joint venture could denote the end of the dollar's role as the dominant medium of international exchange, and more importantly, the end of more than $20 trillion of cheap loans to the U.S. from the rest of the world."
So $20 trillion being the amount that of international debt that the United States owes, I guess.
It has to do a lot with the collateral that nations have to keep on hand in order to use the U.S. dollar for international trades. But for America, though, it translates into incredibly cheap loans, you know, $20 trillion worth at any given time.
Which the cheapness of those loans really is the whole economic structure of the United States kind of hinges on low interest rates and cheap money.
To a great deal, it does, yes. That's given us just an immense amount of economic power. And then this report also goes on to talk about some of the advantages of this digital yuan over traditional non-digital currencies. And it talks about how it has basically all the advantages of blockchain technology. So that means it allows the tracking of goods from, you know, from factory to warehouse to port to container to ship. Every point along the path. And that enables just-in-time deliveries along with just-in-time payments. So those are just some major advantages. And the Frontier Post writes, quote, "The digital yuan well might rewrite the rules of international banking. Because payments can be reliably associated with the movement of goods, the total volume of transactions balances is likely to drop drastically. In other words, digital currencies may be far more efficient than ordinary currencies." So, you know, those are some aspects of this that could very well make it a threat to the U.S. dollar in a way that nothing else before really has been. And I'll just read one final quote here from the Frontier Post. This is very powerful. It says, "Historians still quibble about what event marked the end of the Roman Empire. some future historians might choose January 16th, 2021 as the fatal moment for the American empire, because that's when the People's Bank of China and SWIFT set up the joint venture.
Yeah. Well, before we get into the January the 16th angle, another quote that stands out to me from this article: the United States will wake up 5 or 10 years from now and discover just how dependent it has been on the rest of the world and how much it will cost to cure itself of this dependency. In some ways, I'm kind of reminded of what's happening in the United States right now, where we are seeing the behavior of some of these technology companies that is really unsavory. And then you realize it's really hard to extricate yourself from dependence on these companies. It's almost like our way of life, our standard of living has been established on this foundation. And if we're going to preserve even a modicum of that, we have to keep doing what we've been doing. And it's just given these foreign nations an enormous amount of leverage against us. China has really set itself up in a position of extraordinary power here.
Yes, it has. And I think that's a great point about, in 5 to 10 years, the U.S. may face this reckoning, if not before then.
Right.
But we do have a historical analog to that with Great Britain. You know, for many years, the Bank of England kind of acted as the world's de facto central bank. And then in the 1970s, they had these sterling crises to contend with. They had austerity budgets that were very difficult. And that was because of kind of this decoupling of the world from their currency that had happened in the years before that. And they managed to survive it. But the situation with the U.S. is more dependent than that of Britain was. So it could be catastrophic.
So January the 16th, this is a date that we refer to often. And the fact that this particular analyst is saying it's this date, some future historians might choose January the 16th, 2021 as the fatal moment. This really rings alarm bells for us.
For sure, yeah. You know, it is early days with this new digital yuan. It's hard to say for sure whether it will materialize into a game-changing development. But, you know, the fact that it was launched on January 16th really does make it catch our eye here at the Trumpet. January 16th was the day back in 1986 that Mr. Herbert W. Armstrong died. He was a man that a great global work was done through during his many years as the pastor general of the Worldwide Church of God. And that was a work that was done through him that really couldn't have happened as it did just on a human level. So it was clear that God was working powerfully through him. And ever since his death, there have been several major developments that have happened on or around January 16th, year after year. You know, we've seen major earthquakes on that day, one back in 1994 in California, and then an even bigger one the next year in Japan. There have also been milestone laws that have been passed, such as President Obama's gun control executive orders that were passed in 2013. Then the Supreme Court's decision 2 years later to hear arguments about redefining marriage. There have been landmark deals struck between nations, including the implementation of that Iran nuclear deal that we talk about so often. There was also a major court case victory for the church that is behind Trumpet Hour as well, the Philadelphia Church of God. Back on January 16th of 2003, the church reached the initial terms to buy the copyrights to be able to publish and distribute many of the most important books and booklets that Mr. Armstrong had written. So, you know, this is a date that we see attention called to over and over again in just, you know, some very miraculous ways. And the fact that this digital yuan SWIFT entity was established on January 16th could mean that this will end up being something pretty significant. We have to wait and see, but it's definitely an important development. And one of the specific forecasts that Mr. Armstrong made during his long ministry was actually specifically about the U.S. dollar collapsing and that triggering World War III. So that was back in 1968, and he based that all on Bible prophecies, especially prophecies in Leviticus and Deuteronomy. And we've got that all written up in a chapter of our booklet called He Was Right. There's a chapter in there about all that Mr. Armstrong wrote on that topic. And so now, to see this new financial weapon, really, this new dollar-threatening currency set up on the anniversary of his death, and to see that that could accomplish one of the big things that he specifically warned about, that's, you know, I think that shows that this is something to keep an eye on for sure.
Very interesting. And we also have a booklet, January 16th, God's Miracle Day, that goes through even greater detail on some of those events that took place on that day for over the last 30 years. Very interesting booklet, and it does give you a sense of just how important this day is in world events and God guiding world events to point to that. So we'll link to that in our show notes as well. Thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. Even as many nations are considering military cutbacks amid the coronavirus conditions that we're in, Germany is spending record amounts on its military. For this story, we'll go to Richard Palmer.
Yes, Germany has announced its planned military spending for 2021, and yet again, it's another relatively big increase for Germany. They're going to spend 3.2% more than the previous year, an amount that comes to around 64 billion U.S. dollars. And I mean, this is not as much as President Trump has been pushing them to spend. You know, this has been one of the big themes of his interaction with Germany, where he has been accusing them of stealing from NATO because they don't spend more on their military, they don't spend more for their own defense, and kind of lean on America more to do the heavy lifting for them. So it doesn't bring it up to that 2% level that is demanded by the NATO agreement. However, it is still a significant increase for Germany, and it's a significant increase at a time where there still is lots of pressure to cut back, lots of pressure to pour money into social spending and into other parts of the military. So it's Germany is stepping towards that 2% target. And if you think, you know, that 2% target is a pretty big deal. Germany is Europe's largest economy, and if Germany is spending 2% on their military, they're spending more on their military than Russia. You know, you look at what Vladimir Putin is able to do with his military, and you know, when he makes a military deployment, when he speaks, it echoes around the world. That's the kind of clout that really America has been pushing for Germany to have. But this is another step in that direction.
This is the kind of headline that isn't even going to really register on most people's radar. Few people would consider Germany any kind of a military threat in the world today. But there is a lot of evidence to show that this is something that is critical to keep your eye on. Of course, we're looking at it from the standpoint of Bible prophecy that talks a lot about German and European military might in the end time. But even when you evaluate what is happening in Germany in the context of what's happening across Europe, and you think of European military might, a really a different picture emerges.
Right. I mean, you consider Germany as a whole, once they get to that 2% target, that's a lot on their military, a lot of spending on their military. You look at Europe as a whole, and they're doing more and more to coordinate their military. The more effective they get that, they are going to be more and more a superpower. The EU Observer had just a really interesting article this week from somebody who's very much a pro-European, basically saying that the European Union is an empire. You know, they were saying, well, the EU has kind of been accused of being an empire, and they were kind of saying, well, we need to embrace this, and we're not talking. They were writing, well, we're not talking about like this negatively. We can view this positively, and the EU can be a positive empire, but it's an empire. And it was talking about it went through a whole number of different areas where the EU has a lot more clout than is generally realized. And you look at something like the military. You total up all of the European Union spending, and they're roughly on par with China. So they're a big player, and they're getting involved more and more around the Mediterranean and around the Middle East. And the effect of that military spending is going to become bigger and bigger as they kind of pull together and coordinate more closely. That article was How Imperial Is the EU Really? And as that article pointed out, the military component is just one of several. You know, you see Europe having more and more economic dominance. So you do see a continent pulling together in an imperial fashion.
We have this article up on the website from Josue Michels, German military receives another record boost. And he also draws attention to German arms exports as being record-setting and far more showing this kind of military dominance by Germany far more than you would expect.
That's a great point. I mean, Germany's what? They fluctuate somewhere around the third, fourth biggest arms exporter on the planet. So there's a very mature defense agency. I mean, another article that he had recently was talking about the German military developing lasers, something that most countries don't have a mature enough defense industry to be able to do by themselves. It's just the big players that are pioneering in that kind of new technology. So yeah, Germany does have this really advanced defense industry, and at the moment a lot of that equipment is being sold abroad. It wouldn't take much to have that sold at home. And then you bring in the European factor too, and there are a lot of pretty big Italian defense firms and French defense firms and things like Rheinmetall Italia that's technically owned by Rheinmetall, but it's based in Italy, so it doesn't show up on Germany's statistics and things like that. You do have Europe is one of a handful of places where you can buy modern and advanced weapons. But all of this does tie right into one of the top trends we're watching. We have a trends article on this subject, why the Trumpet watches Europe's push towards a unified military. And it's something we're watching because this is something the Bible is so specific on. And you don't even have to understand a huge amount of Bible prophecy to see that. You can look in Revelation chapter 13, Revelation chapter 17, and you see this power that's described as a beast power. And it very quickly talks about it as a military power, a war-making power. It goes and makes war. People look at it and say, well, who can even win a war against this power? And then you can quite easily prove that this is talking about a European power, that it's an empire that's rising, that's led by a church, that's risen before, has all of these different characteristics that match what we've seen in European history. So this is something you can get very directly from the Bible as being important to watch and something that we're seeing rise before us at the moment.
All right. Thank you, Richard. We'll link to that trend article. And also Josue's article about the German military receiving another record boost. And we'll also throw in that link to that laser weapons article with Rheinmetall and MBDA, all in the show notes for today's program. You are listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, a look at how active Iran continues to be in terrorism in several nations, and how President Joe Biden's talk about China is tough, but his actions are actually giving China the upper hand. We'll be right back.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
A couple stories about Iranian terrorism, thankfully both foiled terrorist plots. The first comes from Europe, where a high-ranking Iranian diplomat was just convicted of plotting a major terrorist attack in Belgium. For this, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
That's right. The Iranian envoy Assadollah Assadi, an Iranian diplomat based in Vienna, has been sentenced to 20 years in jail by a Belgian court. He had been planning a bomb attack on a meeting of 25,000 supporters of Iranian exiles, this political grouping that is outlawed in Iran. And attending this meeting were five British MPs. And so it was going to be a bomb attack at this group. It was foiled by police, like you said. It thankfully didn't happen. But this trial and conviction could be a big moment for the way Europe deals with Iran. Assadi is the first Iranian official to be tried for terrorism in Europe since the 1979 revolution. So he's a diplomat. Typically, diplomats are awarded immunity, and his claimed reason for traveling outside of Austria was that he was on holiday. So he was arrested in Germany, and the Germans say, well, your immunity didn't apply. But you've got Iran now being caught red-handed, trying to use the cover of diplomacy, trying to use diplomatic immunity to carry out what could have been a pretty devastating terrorist attack. Now, Europe has been pretty tolerant of Iran in general and pretty tolerant of Iranian intelligence and terrorist activity in Europe. You know, they were very keen on the Iran deal. They worked hard even to try and keep the Iran deal afloat, even while President Trump was turning against it and trying to shut down Iran, and even while more and more evidence emerged of Iran being a destabilizing force for the world. And Iran has, German intelligence especially, has long links with Iranian espionage networks. For example, the Jerusalem Post a few years ago, they noted that Iran has vast espionage infrastructure in Germany that coordinates with its embassy in Berlin. So Iran is used to being able to use its envoys and things like that to conduct these kind of attacks. The unspoken agreement has generally been, well, you don't carry out these attacks within Europe, and we'll kind of turn a blind eye, or we won't get too involved in what's kind of happening. And some of this goes on even to the German Secret Service working with the Iranian Revolutionary Guards during the Yugoslav Wars, where they were on the same side. They were both trying to smuggle weapons into the Albanians against the Serbs. But the point is, with this trial, you can start to see some of that cozy relationship breaking down. Iran hasn't kept its side of the unwritten bargain. It has been using its intelligence networks to attack Europe. And there are signs that this is turning. There are 20 former senior European officials saying that Iran's foreign minister, Javad Zarif, should be held accountable for one of his diplomats being caught carrying a terrorist attack. That, we shouldn't just stop with jailing this guy, but we need to do more to designate Iran's military intelligence or the IRGC as terrorist entities. We have to expel Iranian diplomats. And there must be wider consequences and a change even that these are talking about in Europe's relationship with Iran.
We've tracked this the relationship between Europe and Iran for some time, and there have been terrorist attacks in Europe that have been linked to Iran. This really is on another level when it's a diplomat himself who is being convicted, and Iran continues to deny any involvement. They say that this is all trumped up, and they say that this is illegal for these European nations to do this under international law. It seems like Iran's you go back to that prophecy that we look at so often, that it is an Iranian push that sets off this war between Europe and Iran that is prophesied to take place. And you see a lot of pushing on the part of Iran. As you said, I mean, we have mentioned many times, like, after this terrorist attack, surely Europe is going to step up, and surely this is going to toughen its approach to Iran. At some point, we know that that's going to happen. You would think that when you have this undeniable evidence proven in a European court that it wasn't just an actor, a one-off, a lone wolf, something like that, that this came from the very highest levels of the Iranian government, that they would say it is time to do something more serious here.
Yeah, I think you make a really interesting point. I mean, Europe has taken steps in response to those attacks. We've seen a big increase in Europe getting involved all around the Middle East, getting involved in places like Mali and North Africa and Libya and Algeria, dealing with these different hotspots, but not confronting Iran itself. And I think there's basically Europe's getting kind of pulled in a couple of different directions here in Iran, because perhaps the most consistent part of European foreign policy over the past few years has been an opposition to America. You see them drawing closer to Vladimir Putin's Russia, and you see Putin poisons, then jails one of his opponents, And Germany doesn't bat an eye and is very keen to make sure that this doesn't get in the way of their close relationship. You see Europe drawing closer to China, even while China locks 2 million people in concentration camps and ends the freedom in Taiwan. They're drawing closer to all of these regimes that are against America. You can see from their actions this desire to bring down the American-led order and replace it with something that Europe can play a bigger role in. And so for that reason, that's a pretty compelling reason for Europe to continue to support and work with Iran, especially when Mr. Trump was in power and they just hated him. And Iran was one of his top targets. We've talked also about a kind of an anti-Israel type of bias that you get in Europe as well that plays into it. So there's a lot of reasons for them to keep working with Iran. And I think those pressures are going to continue going forwards. And so maybe we'll see yet another extend and pretend in terms of Iran. But in the long run, like you say, you know, the Bible is very clear. Daniel chapter 11 talks about this clash that is building, and Europe is going to be left with no choice but deal with Iran. And that chapter contains evidence that Europe is working already to prepare for this. They know it's coming. They know that No matter what they can get in the short term with working from Iran, they're going to have to confront them. They're working with different nations across the Middle East to prepare for that confrontation. So it's fascinating to see, I think, these different strands play out. And you know, we talk about this obviously a lot more in our book, The King of the South. That goes through all of the different prophecies. If you want something a bit shorter just to get into Europe's relationship with Iran, again, we have a trends article, Europe and Iran on Course for a Clash of Civilizations, that talks about exactly what the long-term implications are for this alliance. But the Bible does very clearly say you're going to see Europe and Iran clash in a massive way. And so we can expect for that relationship to change radically. And last week, with February 4th, that could be a significant date for that change.
All right. Thank you for that, Richard. Next, we'll learn about an Iranian-sponsored terrorist plot that was stopped in Ethiopia. For this, we'll go back to Brent Noctegal.
Yes, Ethiopia arrested 15 suspects on February 3rd over a plot to attack the United Arab Emirates embassy in Addis Ababa, the capital of Ethiopia. This comes also at the same time that a similar attack was planned against the UAE embassy in Sudan as well, just to the north of Ethiopia. And Israeli officials and Israeli media is reporting that Iran was behind these attempts to blow up parts of the embassy belonging to the UAE in both Ethiopia and Sudan. There was an arrest that was made in Sweden by a dual national that was behind the planning for these attacks. Now, these attacks were foiled before they got to that point. However, it's interesting because it shows that Iran is trying to influence and destabilize these African states. The UAE is one of the main enemies of the Iranians. They're fighting a war against each other inside Yemen right now. We talk about how Saudi Arabia is normally the big kid on the block that's fighting against Iranian influence in Yemen. But the UAE has a massive amount of firepower as well. The UAE currently has a base, or is flying its jets out of a base in Eritrea as well. And so this is a war that's going on in the background between these two states and between the Gulf and Iran, but it's being pushed over now into the Horn of Africa region. And these attacks came just as Ethiopia gets itself into a civil war, its own civil war, which is something that we talked about at the time when Ethiopian forces started to attack the northern region of Tigray, that looked for Iran to use this moment to infiltrate and try and destabilize further this country that is Christian, although has a massive Muslim population. And then here we are a month later, we see that these there were an attempted attacks by Iranians and Iranian-backed terrorists against inside Ethiopia. There was also an Islamic State and Al-Shabaab terrorist attack as well, attempted attack in Ethiopia over the past couple of weeks as well. And so we know now that even Al-Qaeda and Al-Shabaab, they have relationships with Iran and take a lot of their orders from Iran. And so while you might have a different name for these terrorist entities, a lot of the direction is coming from Iran. And it clearly shows that Iran has a focus now on the Horn of Africa region.
The Times of Israel report also mentioned a planned attack in Sudan, in the UAE embassy, and then there was also an explosion at the Israeli embassy in New Delhi, India. The level of which is not in the Horn of Africa, but it does still show just how active Iran is with its terrorist activity. And we just heard about Europe as well. This is definitely something. I mean, there is the specific aspect of the Horn of Africa, and we've talked about Iran's specific strategy for getting a hold of that region. I guess it's also just remarkable to see this level of activity of Iran that has to be. It really does show the threat that Iran poses, and you know, you look at the way that it's pursuing nuclear weapons. And this is a really bad actor here.
Right. And, you know, you will see that. I mean, the Biden administration has played its hand to Iran. As long as they're not recalling up Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, everyone knows and Iran knows that that's showing them that they're choosing Iran over Israel, and as they did refuse to, well, they drew back the designation of the Houthis as being a terrorist organization, which is Iran's number one ally in Yemen, and that was day one, and then they stopped the F-35 sale to the UAE. It stopped Reaper drones going to Saudi Arabia. That was day one as well, and so there is a massive shift coming to the Middle East back to Obama-era foreign policy, and it comes at a time when Iran is still overtly trying to destabilize states through terrorist acts. Now, there might be the occasional different name that's put to one of these different terrorist attacks or terrorist entities. However, it's becoming more obvious that they all answer to Iran. And so what's the United States doing then? Supporting a relationship, potential nuclear deal with Iran, and downplaying their relationship with the allies that are fighting against this terrorist group. So there's lots going into that, but we do see, and Iran is not fearful of any type of Iranian American retaliation or actions against it right now. The whole Syrian civil war was perpetrated underneath the umbrella of negotiations between the United States and Iran. Iran knew that the United States could not come down hard on its support for the Syrian regime because they wanted a nuclear deal. And so it's not surprising to see Iran's increased terrorist activities because it knows it's going to get a free pass from the Biden administration. Sticking to the Horn of Africa, though, we know Iran is going to get more entrenched in this region. And so those attacks are significant, and attempted attacks are significant. And this fits in with a prophecy Mr. Flurry recorded in his article, Libya and Ethiopia in Prophecy.
All right. Thank you very much for that, Brent. The two most heavily populated countries in the world have long had a tense relationship, but Bible prophecy says they're going to join forces. And this week we saw evidence of just that. For this, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yeah, this week the armies of China and India started to simultaneously disengage from a big standoff at their border. So this is, it's around the Pengong Sao Lake area. Over the last 9 months, they've been embroiled there in what's really been the worst border tensions between them since the 1960s. And it's been a very nasty conflict. We talked about this back in June of 2020. That's when the two armies started clobbering each other with clubs and with rods spiked with nails. Mm-hmm. Just a brutal hand-to-hand battle that took place there. And it ended up killing 23 Indian soldiers and as many as 43 Chinese soldiers. So this was a significant clash. And as I said, it constituted the most serious tensions between China and India since their all-out border war in 1967. And this thing was just dragging on and on. there were, you know, there were not many days like that one when all the soldiers were killed, but the two sides were bringing more and more weaponry to each side of the border, and it seemed like they might never find a way to resolve this. But this week, on Wednesday, the Chinese Ministry of National Defense issued a statement saying that the two sides had reached a consensus. He said that this happened during the ninth round of their commander-level meetings. So it took nine rounds, but it looks like they finally made a breakthrough. You know, it's still quite early in this process. Both sides are vigilantly watching the other, because last time that they agreed to disengage, that was actually right before that terrible massacre happened back in June. So there is a trust deficit, and both sides have said that because of that, it'll be a long and a gradual process. But there's a cautious optimism right now that this time it will hold, and it'll bring some peace to this very tense China-India border.
Now, the relationship between China and India, as I mentioned, it is prophesied specifically in the Bible to be very warm, at least a strong alliance, strong enough that they combine forces militarily. Maybe you could just talk about that.
Yeah, sure. The Trumpet has often written about these kinds of frictions that exist between China and India. And we've consistently said that even if minor clashes keep on happening, we don't believe there will be another major conflict between them. And that is because of what Bible prophecy teaches about the role of China and India in the third and final world war. The book of Revelation, if you look especially at the chapters 9 and 16, it shows us that one of the main players in that final world war will be an alliance of Asian countries. It's called the Kings of the East, and it says it'll field an army of 200 million soldiers. So that's a force about 15 times bigger than anything that's ever been formed in history so far. And Ezekiel 38 provides some very interesting details about this force. Verse 2 shows that it'll be led by Vladimir Putin's Russia, and that China, which is included in the area that was anciently called Magog, will be secondary in leadership. And then if you keep reading down in verse 5, India enters the picture. There are some ancient names there that denote modern India, and so that shows that India will be a part of this Kings of the East alliance. So India's already formed a very close relationship with Russia. That part of the equation is pretty much in place. And even though India's relations with China have been under considerable strain, we've always said that that won't last, because ultimately India and China will be allied together. So this news this week about India and China finally disengaging after so many months of serious tension, that could be a big step toward that end, and it could help to prepare the way for India to contribute its massive population and military power to the Kings of the East.
All right. Thank you, Jeremiah. One last story. President Donald Trump took a very tough stand against China in many ways and alerted America to the threat that China poses. The Biden administration says it agrees with Mr. Trump on this point, but its actions paint a different picture. To learn about this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, since he's taken the oath of office, Joe Biden, he's tracked quite a bit tougher in his rhetoric on China than he did as a candidate. But when you look at his policies, especially his environmental policies, you start seeing a very different picture. Now, as you mentioned, President Trump took some flack for some of the stuff he said about China, and then one of the things he took the most flack for is a comment he made when he was still before he was president, about how climate change is a Chinese hoax to convince America to deindustrialize and let China build up. And he backed away from that a little bit when he was president, saying there's not necessarily hard evidence that China was propagating this idea in America. But when you look at the effect, you definitely see that the effect is that America's deindustrializing while China's building up. And the American government, the Biden administration's policies on climate change have a lot to do with that. We talked on this program a bit last week about him canceling the Keystone Pipeline and banning oil exploration on federal lands, which hurts American energy independence. He also, very first afternoon in office, sent a letter rejoining the Paris Climate Change Agreements, which promises that America's going to cut back drastically on its greenhouse gas emissions, but doesn't put China under those same obligations, meaning that America's going to have to get rid of a lot of its industrial capacity, or at least cripple what it can do with its industrial capacity, while China presses forward with theirs. And that's actually something that when President Trump took us out of that agreement, it's one of those agreements we keep bouncing back and forth with President Obama putting us in it and President Trump taking us out, and now Joe Biden putting us back in. But when President Trump first took us out of it, our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Flory, wrote an article we'll put in the show notes titled What the Paris Climate Change Agreement Was Really About. And he has a statement in there that he says, what's happening here is not about the environment. It's about destroying the United States. And that really gets to the heart of the issue. I mean, these climate agreements, and Biden's made a bunch of other policies besides that one, are crippling our industrial capacity and allowing other nations to surpass us. Mr. Flory makes the point in that article that it's really the devil that's behind it. Trump thinks China's behind it. Maybe they have a little bit to do with that. I haven't seen compelling evidence that China's pushing that theory. But the satanic effect of what's happening, crippling America's industrial capacity, is undeniable.
What the Paris Climate Agreement Was Really About is the title of the article, and we will link to that in the show notes. We thank you very much for that, Andrew. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal. And thanks to Jeremiah for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of Ernest Hemingway. The best way to find out if you can trust somebody is to trust them. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
To Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.